Welcome. I'm Bernie Crooks, host of Peace of Mind with Bernie the Attorney, heard right here on WFAS AM 1230 every Thursday evening from 6:05 to 6:35 p.m. This week, our special guest is Dr. Ted Roth, a New York State licensed psychologist. Hello, Ted.
Good evening, Bernie. How are you?
I'm great. It's good to have you on the show.
Thank you very much.
And tell us, Ted, what does a licensed psychologist do?
Well, he does a lot of things, and I do a lot of things. I started out in this field a long time ago. I started before I became a psychologist. I was working as a special education teacher, and then I got a degree in school clinical psych and became an evaluator on an interdisciplinary team trying to evaluate the strengths and weaknesses of a whole gamut of special needs children and try to determine the correct educational placement for them. And then after that, I became involved in the Committees on the Handicapped in New York back in the 70s. And the COH, as they were called, acronymically, were the precursors for the current day CSEs and CPSEs. And then for the past 25 plus years, I've been a licensed psychologist working in private practice up here in Westchester County mostly, occasionally out on Long Island, but primarily in Dobbs Ferry. And what I've been doing has been working with a whole range of people from preschool age children up through geriatric patients, from families and couples and individuals, and work with a large variety of special needs kids and their families.
So it sounds like your entire professional career has been devoted to helping people with special needs or other disabilities.
That's accurate. That's true.
And right now, I also heard you said that you also work with people on the other end of the spectrum, elderly.
I do.
And the work that you do with these people, you also work with their families as well?
I do indeed.
And give me a typical situation, just so sometimes people need to hear a story so that they can visualize in their own mind, okay, so what does this guy really do? You know, without mentioning names, of course, give an example of something you've worked on recently.
In any particular case?
Let's start with the special needs children.
I have a boy who I work with who struggles with multiple disorders, and he at times has been quite depressed. He's been suicidal. I've had to work with the psychiatrist who I work closely with to hospitalize this boy several times. I work with him in regard to the feelings prior to and subsequent to the hospitalization. And then in addition to that, I work with his family, work with mom and dad and sibling, mostly with his mother and father as well, to help them to manage him more effectively, to help him to begin to feel better about himself, to be able to handle with less anxiety, and at times it's debilitating anxiety, his relationships with peers. He has a lot of trouble with that.
And the work involves weekly discussions?
The work involves weekly discussions. Usually it's more than once a week because this is a very serious situation.
And they would come to your office?
Yes, they would and do. Although occasionally when he was hospitalized, I went and worked with him when he was in the hospital.
And when you're working with him, is it with the child alone or is the family also present?
Both.
So you have some sessions alone and some...
Some sessions alone and then some sessions with the entire family and occasionally sessions with just the parents. So this particular situation, I guess I would conceptualize my work as family therapy, although the son is the primary client.
And when you start out with a family like the one you just described, do you set the table and say, okay, these are the issues or the problems, and here's how we're going to go about solving them? Or does it take a while to get your arms around it? I mean, how does that work?
It takes a while. I mean, there are certain issues that are obvious. There are certain behaviors that are presented that are the ostensible issues, And then in the kind of work that I do, and perhaps in the kind of work that you do as well, there are always subscripts, and it's a puzzlement, they said in The King and I. And you have to really search underneath and to try to understand some of the underlying motives of some of the behaviors and some of the symptoms and what they represent. So the first part of the work with this child or with any of my clients is really exploratory. It's data gathering. It's information collection before I really begin to talk about how we're going to proceed. And it's about establishing a comfortable relationship with me.
And as you proceed, how do you know when you're done? How do you know when the case is solved or does it get solved?
Well, I think that is, it's very different. It's very, very case specific because there's no particular time with one person that it's done and with another person it may be forever. I've seen clients who make use of the service that I provide. They'll come in once or twice, they'll summarily stop coming, and then they'll come in again when they're in crisis. So they'll use me as a sounding board when they're in the midst of a crisis. Other people I've seen are shorter term for 6 months, a year or so, and still others I've seen long term. I've seen people as long as 15, 20 years.
I've always marveled at that because when clients come to see us, and you know, our law firm specializes in helping family with special needs kids deal with all sorts of issues,
right.
Invariably they always ask, okay, so you know, how long is it going to take to do what we're hiring you to do, and how much is it going to cost, and tell us about the process. But yet, in your field, it seems like it's more amorphous. You just can't get your arms around it.
It is indeed more amorphous, and I mean, I keep seeing people when I feel that they're still making good use of the process and good use of the relationship with me. And if I still feel that they're gaining, and if they do, then we continue. There are times when I will suggest that we start working toward ending the relationship if I feel that not a lot is going on. And there'll be times when other people will suggest that they end the relationship. One of the problems in this field, which I've been dealing with, and other practitioners as well deal with this, is when after many, many months or years even of working with a client or clients, they suddenly call you one day sometimes and say, we're done. And that's a hard way and not the best way to end relationships. And frankly, most of us are not very good at ending relationships, and this is an example of that. And what I do then is I try to encourage them to come back into the office and discuss what's going on. It could be a lot of things. It could be that they're angry at me. It could be that they're getting pressure at home to stop. It could be that they genuinely feel better and would like to start working toward ending the relationship, but they don't quite know how to do it. And they may be mimicking patterns that they've had and seen throughout their lives in terms of ending relationships.
Have you ever gotten an email saying they want to end the relationship?
I have not. I have not.
Because I think that's where the world is headed. People
don't
like confrontations, to pick up the phone or to send an email.
That's right.
Yeah.
Now, that's an easier way to do it. Yeah, that's absolutely right.
Now, is sometimes one of the reasons the funding? I mean, is this something that people pay out of pocket? Is it covered by insurance, Medicare, Medicaid? How does that work?
It's very specific to the client. Some clients have insurance, and their insurance covers X number of psychotherapy sessions, and they get back, for some clients, they get back a specific number, a specific dollar amount per session. Others have to pay a predetermined copay per session, and then the therapist has to get in touch with the insurance company to get the rest of the monies from the insurance company. There are people who will not, either they do not have coverage or more often than not, they will not make use of their coverage because they are uncomfortable in spite of HIPAA legislation. They are uncomfortable with anyone knowing their private lives. And what is often required by managed care companies is something called an outpatient treatment review, where you have to be much more specific in the work that you're doing with the client, And a lot of clients don't want other people to know this.
So it'll show up on the insurance reimbursement form that somebody went to a psychotherapist?
It doesn't. Yes, it will show that they went to me. And some clients are worried that that other people will find this out. There was an article not so long ago in the New York Times magazine, a couple of years back, where a woman was seeing, she was in an HMO, and she was being treated by a psychiatrist at the HMO for depression. And she went to her gynecologist for a gynecological exam, and the gynecologist gratuitously offered to her, "I can treat your gynecological problems, but I can't deal with your depression." And she was shocked, and she said, "How did you know that I was suffering from depression?" So a lot of people are very private still about emotional problems. It's still stigmatized, unfortunately, even though there are more and more people who do go to psychotherapy, etc. It's still felt as an embarrassment for a lot of people.
How did he know?
Pardon me?
How did he know?
It was on the record.
It was on the record.
Yeah. It was in the chart.
I'm Bernie Crooks, and we're speaking with Dr. Ted Roth, a New York State licensed psychologist. And after this short break, we'll come back and talk about some of the unique issues that siblings of kids with special needs might face. We'll be right back. I'm Bernie Crooks, and we're speaking with Dr. Ted Roth, a New York State licensed psychologist. And Ted has a practice right here in Westchester County, helping families with special needs kids and others, as we've learned. And, you know, one of the most interesting issues for me has always been, Ted, you've got, you know, three or four kids, and one of them has some issues. What are some of the challenges that the quote-unquote typical kids might face?
I worked with one of the things that I do, and it's I'm leading to the answer to that question. One of the things that I do is that I run therapeutic support groups primarily for mothers of children on the autistic spectrum, but also mothers of other special needs children. And one mother with whom I worked said that her teenage son had wished that he was indeed autistic because her younger child was autistic and receiving a lot of attention, a lot of focus. And I think that dramatically illustrates one of the problems, and that is, and it's fairly obvious, that when there is a child who is identified as having special needs, especially when the type of diagnosis requires a tremendous amount of service and a tremendous amount of attention, the siblings suffer. They suffer from a lack of attention, lack of focus, and a sense that they are not as they're not getting as much as they're not being supported as much as the child with special needs. And there's some reality to that, indeed. So that's a big problem. And another one that is problematic for siblings is a tremendous ambivalence at times toward their brother or sister who has been identified with special needs. Some kids are parentified. What I mean by that is that they are given the task to be surrogate parents because it's simply overwhelming for the parents to handle all of the demands that a special needs child requires. And the siblings then become substitute or surrogate caretakers. Now, with that situation, they both get perks in that they get a lot of attention, they get appreciation from the parents, but at the same time, they complain later on in their lives that they've lost a sense of their own childhood, that they had to grow up much too quickly in order to care for their disabled brother or sister, and there is a tremendous amount of and it's not always conscious, but there's a tremendous amount of resentment that is underlying their position. There are other kids who are much more blatant about their distaste for their sibling, and they will say, "I'm not doing it. I'm not going to have a thing to do with my brother or sister." They are usually embarrassed. They are, quote, unquote, mortified, especially if they're teenagers, but then teenagers are always mortified, as you may know, and regardless. And they really will just have very little connection with their special needs SIP. So there's that. There's a sense of embarrassment. They get very angry when they have their friends come over and the younger brother or sister who is disabled wants to get involved and is disruptive of their activities. This happens with typical kids as well, but it's more exaggerated when you have children with special needs. So those are some of the issues that SIBs face.
So what do you tell them? What's the best thing to do? Have play dates at your other friend's house so that they don't have to come over and deal with your brother?
Sometimes that is not a bad idea. Other times you may work it out so that your brother can participate in some of the activities earlier on, and then the other members of the household take over and take the brother out of it. Because, frankly, it is, in this case, the adolescent's time to be with his friends.
Is it ever possible that this would have a positive effect on the other siblings and make them more understanding that, you know, the world is not perfect?
Yes, I think it does. I think it makes them more sensitive and are less. There are some children who are very, very sensitive kids, period. And when they have experience with siblings who are special needs kids who don't act the same way that everybody else does, who may look differently than everybody else does, it does increase their level of tolerance. That's true. But those other emotional pieces are there. And one of the problems is that that the focus, as I said earlier, is typically on the special child and his or her needs, and that leaves kind of a gaping hole, I think, internal gaping hole in the siblings of this child.
So even a sibling who appears to be dealing with it well and tries to include the special needs sib in the activities and maybe benefiting it from it in some way, at some point in his or her life is going to have some sense of, hey, I was cheated?
I think so. And if they don't, then they're in denial, because they were.
So then how do we help them overcome that so that after the parents are gone and, you know, all this person has left are basically their siblings, how do we get them to overcome that so that they can, you know, help out when needed?
Well, I don't know that they necessarily will overcome it. I think that what is necessary, though, is to provide them, as it is also necessary to provide other family members with regular opportunities to talk about these things, either within family meetings or at a psychotherapist's office or within sibling groups or in other special agencies that cater to SIBs of special needs kids, that it gives them a chance to vent it, to share some possible problem-solving techniques that other siblings have used, and to have special time scheduled with them and their parents where their special needs brother or sister is not included. It's important for them to have special time as well, and that often goes by the boards, unfortunately.
So the parents have to get over the guilt of leaving the special needs kids home while the typical kids can go out to dinner without the brother.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right, because there is a tremendous amount of guilt. And frankly, I think that some parents never get over it. Some parents are always feeling hugely responsible, incorrectly so, for their son or daughter's disability, and they never forgive themselves for this. And it plays out in so many different ways, and unfortunately, this is one of them.
We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we'll talk about some of the additional challenges that parents have and how they may or may not be dealing with them. I'm Bernie Crooks. This is Peace of Mind with Bernie the Attorney, and we'll be right back. Welcome back. I'm Bernie Crooks, host of Peace of Mind with Bernie the Attorney. We're heard right here on WFAS AM 1230 every Thursday evening from 6:05 to 6:35 p.m. Our guest this week is Dr. Ted Roth, a New York State licensed psychologist, and we've been talking about some of the issues that families have to confront when there's a special needs child. And in particular, I'd like to talk about some of the issues that parents confront. How do you keep a marriage together when you've got this type of situation? And what are some of the other issues that people have, Ted?
Well, I think, as you know, Bernie, the numbers are staggering in terms of separation and divorce with couples who have special needs children. And I think what happens is, and I've alluded to it a couple of times earlier in the broadcast, what happens is that the in a typical situation is that when you have a diagnosis, there is shock, dismay, confusion, devastation, guilt, all of those really horrible, horrible feelings. And then what happens is that there is a focus of energy on trying to find out how to best deal with the identified problems, and sometimes it takes years in order to really assemble the best team of professionals to work with this. And what happens in that process is that that's where the focus is. So, and typically the mom is the person in charge of this program. And it's a mom who, in many cases, is a professional woman who has decided to stay home, and because she simply feels that she has to do it, given the tremendous time demands that this situation poses for her. And when that happens, her focus then becomes that, and her husband, who is typically out earning a living out of the house, then comes back, and there is an estrangement that exists between them, and perhaps it preceded the birth of their child. But typically, once the child is born, and once the child with special needs is born, it exacerbates it, and sometimes to a point of a tremendous sense of polarization between the two, a tremendous sense of conflict, a lot of blame. There's a lot of blaming that goes on. There's a lot of self-blame. Oh, my God, what did I do wrong when I was pregnant? How could I have done that? How come I didn't do this? Why did I eat this? Why didn't I listen to this doctor, et cetera, et cetera? And in addition to that, there sometimes is a lot of other blame. How come you didn't fix it soon enough? How come you're not sensitive to the needs of our child? The mother may be saying to the husband. A lot of husbands I have found are involved on the weekends with the activities, and there's a whole circuit of activities that a lot of kids attend on the weekends. But there are also a lot of husbands who are embarrassed by the fact that their child has been identified as a special needs child. There sometimes is a lot of denial, and there's a tremendous amount of resentment on the part of the husband toward the wife because she's so attentive to the needs of the special child, and on the part of the wife toward the husband because he is so not validating her efforts and is so disconnected from her. And this leads to a lot of harsh feelings, a lot of interpersonal conflict, and if it is not taken care of, it can lead to separation and divorce. And when I say taken care of, what I mean is that they really need to begin to address these things directly. If they can't do it themselves, then they need someone to help them. And it could be someone like myself. It could be someone within a support group. It could be some religious counselor. It could be other friends or family members who might be able to help them. The thing that's necessary is that they begin to reestablish their sense of couplehood, which has been lost and sometimes, frankly, is forever lost. And they need to do this by being able to discuss their different points of view about this, by trying to forge out time to spend together, which is often at a premium, and that is usually the first to go. That is the couple time. That's the first to go. And without that, it just continues to slide downhill.
Do you find that men have a tougher time than women dealing with this?
I think, no, I don't know if it's tougher. It's different. It's different. I think that men I think they tend to be more embarrassed about this. And this is a general comment. It's not always true, of course. But I think that they are more embarrassed. that their son or daughter is handicapped. But that's not to say that there aren't a lot of guys who I've met who are working very, very collaboratively with their wives to work on behalf of their disabled child.
All right, we're going to take one last break, and then I'll come back and we'll wrap up with Dr. Ted Roth. Welcome back. This is Bernie Crooks. I'm speaking with Dr. Ted Roth, New York State licensed psychologist. And just wrapping up here, Ted, I'm sure people have a lot of questions and they'd love to be able to get in touch with you. How do you prefer people to contact you?
Well, I think the easiest way, Bernie, is for them to give me a call at 914-674-0573, and I'd be delighted to speak with them about whatever they'd like to talk about.
Anything else you want to say in closing?
I thank you very much for inviting me on, and hope that I can come back and chat some more with you.
It's been our pleasure. It's been an enlightening conversation. Until next week, I'm Bernie Crooks, host of Peace of Mind with Bernie the Attorney. Good night.